Hello, everybody. It's another edition of The Throwback. I'm your host, Ryan the Potman, and this is
Jimmy the Radio Man.
And we got a very cool lineup today. The author of the book Console Wars and video game expert, Blake J. Harris, will be on the show talking about the era of 90s video games and the rivalry between Sega and Nintendo.
Let me tell you something here now. That Console Wars is a good book. I love me some of them video games, Daddy.
Now, Jimmy, when we talk about 90s video games, what console was your favorite? For me, personally, I love the Sega Genesis.
Oh, I like me some of that Virtual Boy, Daddy.
Oh, wait, Virtual Boy? That Sega Genesis or Super Nintendo?
Nah, baby, I love that Virtual Boy, Daddy. I feel like the Terminator when I put on them shades on kicking Wario's ass. I played that game all the time at my Uncle Billy's house until I got dizzy that one time. I threw up on my aunt's cat. Yeah, that was a bad day for all of us.
Wait, you threw up on your aunt's cat playing Virtual Boy?
Yeah, Daddy, it happened so fast, the cat still hasn't been the same since.
Oh, what happened?
You started farting around the clock like a grown-ass man, Daddy, and so does to this day, 21 years later.
Wait, 21? Your cat's still... You know what? Never mind. Anyways, folks, if you like what you hear today, be sure to check us out on Audio Boom, Spotify, or Block Talk Radio for other great exclusive interviews. Now, here's our exclusive interview with Console Wars author and video game expert, Blake J. Harris.
You are listening to The Throwback Podcast, your stop for everything 90s. This is a throwback exclusive.
My guest joining me at this time is a video game expert who has been featured on CNN, MSNBC, and other media outlets, and is also the author of the book Console Wars. I am pleased to welcome Blake J. Harris. Blake, how are you?
I'm good, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. Before we get into the interview, just a question. What inspired you to write a book about video games? What was your inspiration?
That's a good question. Honestly, the inspiration was that I wanted to read this book or a book like it.
Right.
So, you know, initially, before I even thought that I would write Console Wars or write a book about video games, I just didn't remember going into a Barnes & Noble here in New York on 86th Street. It's a huge Barnes & Noble. And, I was looking for the video game history section. I figured it would be near the film history section or the music history section. But as you could probably guess, there was no such section for video games.
Right.
And when I asked the woman at the information desk, she pretty much laughed at me. And at that point, I knew very little about video games, about the history of video games, at least the business of video games. Right. That was the point. I wanted to find out some behind-the-scenes stuff. And I was kind of shocked that that they didn't have anything in stock, that there were so few books that actually existed. And there are some good ones. I really enjoyed David Sheff's book, Game Over, about Nintendo and Stephen Kent's history of video games. So I was able to order those books online.
Right.
But, for a big bookseller like Barnes & Noble to not have a single video game book in stock was kind of odd to me. And then, it wasn't like I left Barnes & Noble that day thinking, aha, I'm going to write Console Wars. But
right. That
was, kind of the kernel of the idea of like, well, that's weird. I think that a lot of people would be interested in a book like that.
Yeah.
And that kind of led to my writing it.
Oh, okay. That's cool. Now, how did you get Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg on board? Like, I believe they wrote the foreword to your book, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. One of the nice things about writing this kind of a story, this kind of a business story, is that I felt like I learned a lot of lessons just by writing it in the same way that I would hope maybe some readers would take away some lessons. And, one of the things that Sega did really well was to align themselves with brands and celebrities that were on the rise or more successful than themselves.
Right.
Especially at first. And so, initially, at the point when I knew I was going to write this book, but I still hadn't written it yet, I had written some sample chapters
right. For
a book proposal. Then I knew it would be an uphill battle to do anything since I had no reputation. And I also really wanted to do a film project, or at least I thought there would be, not necessarily me doing it, but I thought there would be a great film version of the story.
Yeah.
So I literally just Googled celebrity gamers, and Seth came up first on this list, and it mentioned how he was into Nintendo games. And
right.
So, I guess, I had my manager email a treatment over to him, and I had no expectation that I would ever hear back from him. You know, like I was a hot shot writer hobnobbing with celebrities left and right. And,
right.
You know, it was like a shot in the dark, but I said, like, you know, why not just email him or send his company the stuff? And I was frankly shocked when I heard back that his company had reviewed my overview, my treatment, and actually liked it and was interested in meeting. So that's kind of how it all started.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. Yeah, so for those people who don't know, going into like the video game aspect, what caused the video game crash of 1983? Like, what's the backstory towards that?
Sure. So, you know, I think that any time we speak broadly about history and things like crashes, whether it's the stock market or video games, you know, there's a little bit of an oversimplification. But I'll tell you, like, the oversimplified version right. is that, you know, home video games, first started in the mid-70s with Atari's the 2600. Well, first with Pong and then the Atari 2600.
Right.
And by the end of the 70s, it proved to be super successful business, and you got a lot of other companies who wanted to follow Atari's lead. There was, you know, like the ColecoVision and Mattel and Television.
Right.
And so you got a lot of these companies. And so there's a lot of different consoles. And then you also have a whole glut of games. There is no really structure. There's basically, you know, it was like printing money to these video game companies. And you know, you have to go back in time and remember this is a period before the internet. Before, basically, you would have any idea what you were buying.
Right.
And nowadays, you can do your due diligence. You can watch trailers. But I remember even as a kid, when I would buy a video game, it was basically just a leap of faith. At best, it would be mentioned in Nintendo Power, which obviously didn't exist in the early 80s,
yeah.
Before Nintendo launched the console. So there was just a glut of, you know, there was an oversaturation, and then ultimately just a glut of really bad games. And, you know, this is sort of epitomized by that game E.T., which is based on the popular movie.
Yeah.
And is definitely the worst video game I've ever played. And it was, you know, famously, they ended up burying like 2 million cartridges of E.T. in the New Mexico desert.
Did they recently dig those up? Like, I think about a year or two ago.
They did dig them up for a documentary that Zach Penn did. So I don't know if it was really 2 million, but they definitely did bury them in a landfill.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's a pretty good... Really, you know, for a writer, it's always good when you can kind of have these metaphors or these personifications, I should say, where you have this big budget or this very popular movie, and then you have a game, which we can all relate to today, that we know there's a lot of games that are based on popular properties and movies. And in that case, it was like put together in 2 months, and it was a, you know, piece of garbage. So, to put it lightly.
Yeah.
And you know, as a consumer, I'm sure that I was born in 1982, so I didn't have, you know, I wasn't a consumer looking at video games at that time as a baby. But, you know, if I was a kid at the time, I probably would have begged my parents to get E.T. I love the movie. I love video games. Why would I not want an E.T. video game? And I would have been so disappointed. and you know, I'm sure we'll get into this later, but you see a lot of what Nintendo did in their early days of the console business was strategies like the seal of approval and stuff like that, which were meant to prevent against some of the stuff that happened with that video game crash.
Right. So, like, before the actual crash happened, Atari was pretty much, like, the leader in, like, video games at that point, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I think that definitely there were people who preferred ColecoVision or a television or maybe even other consoles. But, you know, Atari was first to market, and they had such a, you know, perceptual mind share over the audience. Everyone knew Atari, everyone knew Pong. That even if maybe, like we see today with different generations of consoles, if some, you know, people, you know, there's ups and downs, I think that Atari at least was considered like the premium brand and had the best brand name. And so, you know, in a way, how they went would dictate to some extent how the industry went.
Right. That Crash lasted for almost 2 years. It didn't really, the video game industry didn't really go back on track until like Nintendo got into the picture. What made Nintendo such a hit so fast and made it like pretty much so successful the way it did?
Oh man, that's a great question. There's a lot of things. And that's like, you know, that is really where my book picks up in a way. I guess narratively it starts in 1990 with Sega.
Yeah.
But that's like, you know, I'll just, before I fully answer your question, I'll just say that, like, you know, there is almost like a myth that it's not a bad myth, but we kind of just assume as consumers that if there's good products will succeed. You know, we don't always take into consideration the context. And for Nintendo, so given how popular the 8-bit NES would become, and given how awesome it was, as I'm sure most of us, almost every one of us owners would say,
right,
it's like we just assume, oh yeah, of course Nintendo would succeed. But actually interviewing the people who were there at that time, and specifically the people whose job it was to literally sell the Nintendo to stores, like who would go into the Wiz or who would go into Crazy Eddie's and have to say, hey, we want to have you sell the Nintendo system in your store. And they were told, like, no way, because video games had crashed. You know, no one wants a video game. That fad was over.
Yeah.
So it was really an uphill battle for them in a way that people definitely did not realize at the time, because it's, you know, there's no reason that we should. We're kids, and also a lot of companies struggle in different ways. But you know, basically, how did Nintendo get over that hurdle? Is you know, you got to give credit to those salespeople who didn't take no for an answer when they walked into Crazy Eddie's or the Wiz. And then at the end of the day, it really was kind of the same thing that differentiates Nintendo now from the other console or the other software makers and hardware makers. It was just really the quality of their content.
Right.
You know, Mario Brothers, which was one of their early titles, and they had about, I think, 16 others at launch. Mario Brothers was not one of the initial launch titles, but they had their games were so different than the Atari games. They were so much better.
Right.
And you know, even today, you know, one thing I've said before is that I think that people who've read Console Wars can probably assume that that my relationship with Nintendo has been contentious at times. So there's parts of the book they're not super happy with, but at the same time, they were super helpful in other ways. But regardless of anything critical that I've ever said or written about them, you know, I really want nothing but the best for Nintendo, and that's because in 35 years of my life, or whatever, 30 years as a video game player, I've never bought a Nintendo product and not liked it. You know, I've never, they've always made everything they've produced worth something, and that's so unlike any other company that you can think of. You know, any other brand that you like, there's stuff that you love about it, but there's probably times when you felt like you got burned, or you felt like, oh, I wish I had known. But Nintendo really does ensure that what you buy is a quality product, and you got to give them a lot of respect for that.
Right.
Yeah.
What did Atari do so wrong for it to collapse like it did and not like really recover? Did they just didn't adapt with the times like Nintendo did?
I mean, I would say that, like as happens a lot of times, with successful companies that have a big market share, I think that they got complacent.
Right.
They, you know, like, I mean, let's go back to the ET example. They had this great license for a game, and they put together a game in a couple of months that really is as bad as the rumors are, or, you know, it's really one of the worst games of all time. And they sold it. And, you know, think about what that means. Like, it's not just, like when you're actually selling accessories, it means that we're saying, hey, we're going to take your money and you're going to get this. Like, that is, you know, of course, it's the consumer's choice to buy it or not. But you are putting that out there, right? You know, think about if any other company just put out a piece of crap and, you know, let millions of customers buy something or try to sell it to them. You know, and I think that's kind of symptomatic of where the company was at the time,
right?
Where you could talk yourself into that. And, And I think that there, you know, in a way, in a good way, the video game crash was like a market correction to those kinds of practices.
Right. Yeah, I believe Atari even tried to do a comeback in the early to mid 90s with the launch of the Atari Jaguar, and that didn't really take off either.
Yeah, and you know, I think that again, this is I apologize because I don't remember the details super well, but at some point there was a split between Atari, like the brand, and the hardware company, and then Atari, like their software assets.
Right.
But over the years, you know, we see stuff from their software assets that come about, which tend to do kind of well because of the retro fandom.
Yeah.
And then also we see some hardware efforts, and those, you know, as you referenced, have not been super successful. And that's just because it's so hard, and every generation of console makes that even harder, in my opinion.
Right.
Because the cost of all this stuff gets astronomical. That a company like Atari, you know, basically, it's not a surprise to me that the three main console players are, Sony, whose history is in consumer electronics, not in video games or arcade games.
Yeah.
Microsoft, whose history is in computers, and then Nintendo, who is like the leading video game company.
Yeah.
If you were to just take a look at the history of video games, so you know, it's so expensive and it's so hard to compete as a console maker,
right,
as a hardware maker.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if Atari can get back on track.
Yeah, going into the 1990s, Nintendo pretty much controlled 90% of the industry. How was Nintendo able to keep the momentum they were on? Was it like marketing? Was it just listening to consumers' demands, being innovative, or was it just like a combination of things?
It was definitely a combination of things, but interestingly enough, I would say that it's not what you suggested, which is something I would have guessed is something that most companies do. Like, I would say that they did not listen to customer demand. That's something that's kind of unique about Nintendo, and still to this day is more true of them than other companies. I say that slightly tongue in cheek, because obviously Nintendo has a lot of disparate fans and
right,
delivers what fans want. But even if you think about like I talked to a lot of marketing guys at Nintendo, and their instinct, as marketers do when they sell toothbrushes or sodas, is to do studies with potential customers and figure out what there would be a demand for. What do the customers want? But Nintendo didn't really care what the marketing side wanted. They were focused on product development and figuring out what they thought people would want. Basically, like, if we make it, if we build it, they will come. As opposed to like, everyone tell us what you want and we'll figure out how to make a sports game and a fantasy game. So Nintendo really did put a lot of faith in themselves. And for the most part, that's paid off over the years.
Right. They really care about the quality of their games too. I think like for all the third party developers, weren't they only restricted to like making like 5 games a year or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Nintendo only let third party developers make 5 games a year, because of what we discussed earlier, the quality control issue. And that is like a super admirable thing to me. That, as you can guess, when the games were so successful, that angered a lot of third-party developers, yeah, because they felt like, what do you mean? But we're printing money. We want to print more money, or we want to try other things. And then you're basically having, but it was admirable to me because, the more titles that these third-party developers make, the more money Nintendo is going to make in the short run, because they're selling these cartridges. They were actually producing the cartridges for these third-party developers. Also, each game to some extent was like a lottery ticket. It could be the one that takes off.
Right.
But Nintendo actively chose not to take those short-term gains because they wanted to create a stable marketplace. So I think anytime a company is passing up, profits for what they think is a better ecosystem is impressive. And then, as you can imagine, and as I'm sure that at some point when companies can only make 5 games, they kind of figure out a way to game the system.
Right.
No pun intended. Where, all right, well then let's buy a we'll buy a different company or we'll start a subsidiary and then we can make five more games. So it's kind of a hard system to enforce because there are sort of like loopholes to it. Yeah. But at least philosophically, Nintendo was super focused on quality control. And we should also mention that even if you know, a company could make five games or eventually more than that, it still always had to go through Nintendo's quality control process, which, again, that was something that third-party developers complained about because you could submit a game in January and maybe not get approval on it, if at all, until 10 months later. Wow. And that's super frustrating because you want to make the game. But, you know, to some extent, I'm sure that was Nintendo just being a little bit domineering. But there was also a philosophical underpinning of we want to do right by our customers and making sure that that was the best possible version of the game.
Okay. Now, around what time, what year did the Sega Genesis launch? Was it like around the late 80s?
Yeah, so the Sega Genesis initially launched in August of 1989. So it was the Sega Genesis here in the United States and the Mega Drive over in Japan. And initially, this is something I did not get into in my book, but I always kind of thought it fascinating that, you know, before, in the minds of Sega employees, and there were so few at the time, because, you know, who would have thought they were going to be successful, such a small market share compared to Nintendo. But, like, if you talk to early Sega of America employees, their first battle was not Sega versus Nintendo. It was Sega versus TurboGrafx. And, you know, at the time, retailers thought that TurboGrafx was going to be more successful than the Genesis. So that alone was kind of a surprising thing. Genesis was able to hold their ground and eventually surpass TurboGrafx as the, you know, 16-bit platform. It was still super, super unsuccessful compared to Nintendo, but at least, you know, kept them around as the second player in the market.
Right. It was called the Sega Overdrive in Japan when it was launched, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was the Mega Drive.
Yeah. How come it wasn't as successful in Japan? Was it just, it was more of a Nintendo market?
Well, that's like, that kind of gets to the heart of my book. You know, it's something that I did not realize when I first started this, you know, back in the day when I went to that Barnes & Noble and was just curious to read about this. I had always assumed that the Sega versus Nintendo 16-bit battle here in the United States was kind of a global thing. Maybe it changed by a percentage points in different countries or different regions, but I really had no idea that the Mega Drive was not successful at all in Japan, or you know, it never really cracked like 20% of the market, whereas the Genesis here did at one point hit 60%. And the reason why is a lot of what the book is about in some ways. You know, I think that one of the most interesting things to me is that for the most part, the library of titles on the Genesis in America and in Europe and other countries versus the Mega Drive in Japan, the library was essentially the same. So, yeah. You know, you're competing with the same game. So you can't really say like, well, the American, had all these different better games. That's an oversimplification. There was definitely, localized games and different types of games. But really, you know, that to me, the fact that it's the same underlying product kind of tells me that it's a big marketing issue and also just like a business distribution type issue. Like you mentioned, you know, Nintendo really was so dominant in Japan and it seems to have been harder there, especially at the time, to compete against a monopolistic force. Whereas at least in the United States, we have laws that maybe are not always enforced, but you know, Nintendo at some point did face an FTC investigation and had issues with monopolistic practices.
Did it initially catch everybody by surprise when Sega got so successful in North America compared to how it was when it was originally in Japan?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, because what was fascinating about it was that you know, the Genesis or the Mega Drive, whatever, the 16-bit console from Sega launched in 1989. But it wasn't until 1991 in the United States when it started to get very successful. So it wasn't like, you know, right out of the gate, it was a big hit. And a lot of the reason that it took as long as it did or that it even happened at all, was because of, you know, in my opinion, and what the book covers a lot is, you know, Tom Kalinske being the CEO of Sake of America and right. his strategy and his team there. And also Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog came out in the summer of 1991, like a few weeks or a couple months before the Super Nintendo hit.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, that was kind of like the relaunch of the Genesis, and that was when it started to really make a huge cultural impression.
Right. So well, the Sega Genesis was kind of like the first console to be targeted towards like an older audience. They were like pretty much the first system to like introduce like blood and adult themes in video games, weren't they? Pretty much, almost.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can't say that they were the first to introduce blood. I haven't reviewed enough games ahead of time, but definitely as like as a selling point.
Yeah.
The Genesis was explicitly focused on an older audience, and it's kind of cool that that's the case, because I think that really is what changed, you know, what makes them historically super relevant, that they had a mentality that video games should be more of a mainstream entertainment product that's not just for kids. But it's interesting that the way it started was basically one of the appeals of writing the book to me, where it's like, how can a company with, you know, 1/10 or 1/20 or 1/100, whatever the number is, you know, with so much less resources than Nintendo, compete right. against this big Goliath? And the answer was like, well, we definitely can't compete in the same market as them. We can't go after kids 14 because we're going to get our clocks cleaned.
Yeah.
So as a strategic point, they thought, well, you know, Nintendo is not focused so much on people older than 14. So we should focus on those people. So basically by just doing what Nintendo did not do, you ended up hitting this older audience, which, you know, ended up becoming what Sega was all about.
Right. I think we just touched on this, but is it safe to say that the launch of the Super Nintendo was like a response to how successful the Sega was becoming, closing in on their Nintendo's market share?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I would say that not really. I would say definitely, because, you know, it takes a lot of time and resources for a company to plan a product launch. And since Sega wasn't super successful until Sonic came out in June of 1991, and the Super Nintendo came out in August of 1991. It also came out
yeah.
earlier in Japan. You know, I don't think it was, it definitely was not like a response per se to, oh no, Sega's doing so well, we need to do something. But at the same time, I would say that if not for Sega, and if not for TurboGrafx even, basically if people were not pushing 16-bits and really trying to push the industry, sure that Nintendo would have launched the Super Nintendo or the Super Famicom a little bit later if they didn't feel some pressure, even if it was not a very competitive pressure at that point.
Right. Besides the library of games, what was the main difference between the Super NES and the Sega Genesis? It really seemed like both systems were like neck and neck for like what it sold, like in terms of what the console wars was in like in the 90s. I feel like the Super Nintendo and the Sega Genesis rivalry was what made the whole console wars at its peak between Nintendo and Sega. Because they really were neck and neck, in my opinion, in terms of like popularity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what a fun subject. That, you know, basically, to me, that is the great console war.
Yeah.
And there are so many pros and cons to each side that it's, that, you know, we can go into any of them for a while. But like, you know, I would say that the library of games, you know, as with today, you know, what exclusive companies have and all that is a big part of what shapes the console wars.
Yeah.
But one cool thing with Sega Nintendo was basically like the question of like why did Sega have a different type of library of games and what did that mean? And what I mean by that is that Nintendo, you know, historically, their first-party games have been amazing. The Mario games, the Zelda games, the Mario Kart games, Smash Bros., and all that. But they have had difficulty with third-party developers. We touched on that earlier from the previous generation, just from like a business development standpoint. And that kind of persisted in this battle. And that's important because they did a really good job of befriending third-party developers. And the point that I'm getting to is that, you know, we could debate the technological merits of the Genesis versus the Super Nintendo.
Right.
But eventually, you know, if you have one developer who's going to, you know, spend, let's say, a year developing for one system, even if it's a better technological system, versus another developer who's going to spend 4 years developing for a system that maybe is even worse, I think that you're probably going to get better results from the one who spends 4 years, because they'll figure out the tricks on how to optimize the system and stuff like that. And that was definitely the case with Sega, because they had such better third-party relations. And, you know, one thing that I'm thinking of is I talked to a lot of people from Electronic Arts, and they would always tell me that the games on the Genesis were so much better than on the Super Nintendo. And so I think that's pretty symptomatic of how it was with a lot of things. For
third-party
games,
right? Yeah, the Sega Genesis was pretty successful throughout its entire run, but there were like issues behind the scenes between Sega America and Sega Japan, right? There was like an internal conflict going on between those two companies.
Yeah, definitely. Because you know, from 1991 until 1995, when the Sega Saturn launched, you know, there. Basically a replacement console or the next generation console. The Genesis was really successful for the most part, but it did begin to wane towards the end of that, especially as Nintendo came out with games like Donkey Kong Country. And then also, you know, a lot of, you know, when people think about the decline of the 16-bit era with Sega, I think the first thing that they think of is stuff like Sega's peripherals, like the Sega CD and Sega 32X, and these add-ons that were hardware-type add-ons, and basically feeling like Sega was, at that point, trying to sell them a lot of extra stuff they didn't need, or that they were, you know, Sega was not really pushing a singular vision for the company, and that those, you know, that hardware difference was also part of the divide between Sega of America and Sega of Japan, which in the end, in my opinion, is what doomed the company, at least from a hardware perspective.
Right. It's true, too, that sometime in the mid-90s that the Sega was trying to partner up with Sony to create a new console, which eventually became the Sony PlayStation, but something fell through and Sega didn't do it anymore because of the conflict between Sega of America and Sega Japan?
Yeah. So, you know, in the summer of 1991 at the Consumer Electronics Show, Nintendo famously spurned Sony. You know, originally it was going to be the Nintendo PlayStation, which was going to be like a CD attachment add-on to the Super Nintendo. And then Sega, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about being the company who, you know, did with Nintendo, or who, you know, who basically made their business strategy to do what Nintendo was not doing, and to some extent that included partnering up with people who didn't like Nintendo or who had bad experiences with Nintendo, and one of those companies was Sony. And initially that collaboration was with Sony as a third party developer.
Right.
Sony had ImageSoft and they were making games. But they did have hardware aspirations to some extent, but they at least had hardware capabilities based on, you know, 50 years however many decades of making great consumer electronics. At some point, the conversation did shift to a potential partnership between Sony and Sega in the hardware space. You know, that ended up being nixed by Sega of Japan because they wanted to go with their own system, which was the Sega Saturn. And, you know, I would say they were just not super interested in working with another company. That along with what happened with Silicon Graphics, which was another potential partnership for Sega of America, which was spurned by Japan, and that ended up becoming, you know, the Nintendo 64. Those were big parts of the conflict between Sega of America and Japan. And, you know, I just want to note that it's not like Sega had the Sony PlayStation, you know, in one hand and the Nintendo 64 in the other hand, and had to choose and basically chose neither. Like, basically, these were not finished products. I don't want to take away credit from Nintendo and from Sony to make it sound like Sega was hugely involved in the development of those consoles. But just the fact that Sega had the opportunity to work with those companies and probably could have something very comparable to either of those systems if that had been a priority.
That would have been interesting if the Sega had collaborated with either of those two. The industry would have been different a little bit, seeing how those consoles would have came out.
Definitely. I mean, I spent so much time thinking about this. I definitely spent a lot of time thinking about like the what-if scenarios. And I would have loved to see what would have happened if either of those scenarios had happened.
Why did Sega never recover after the Sega Genesis? Was it because of the whole Sega America, Sega Japan conflict? Like, they came out with the Sega Saturn, they came out with the Sega Dreamcast, but they never really had the same as much of success as the Sega Genesis did.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of factors. Also, one thing I would say is that, you know, the scope of my book really is more of like 1985, 1996, but, you know, the NES and the Genesis years. So I haven't done enough research into when they actually pulled the plug on the Dreamcast and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I can only really speculate. But I think that it really is a lot of what I was saying earlier about just the astronomical cost of being a hardware company, like, you know, with each successive generation. And so even though, in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinions, the Dreamcast was an awesome console, you know, little problems potentially stemming from that conflict between Sega of America and Sega of Japan, or maybe for other reasons, you know, little problems felt like big problems because everything costs so much money. You know, it was such high stakes game, and a company like Sega, which was you know, not managed with the same discipline as Nintendo, though few companies in the world are, you know, was just really not able to navigate that. And I do think that the relationship between Sega of America and Sega of Japan is at the heart of that. I think that if they had had a much more symbiotic relationship, the outcome would have been different.
Yeah.
So that is something that I do believe made a huge impact.
Yeah. The success of this period in video games is still being felt today with the, you know, the release of the mini NES and Super NES and Sega Genesis portable stuff coming out. Like, you're still seeing the success for that period, like, yeah, today. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love that. And, you know, I always ask myself, like, oh, how come people love that period of gaming so much? And some of it is certainly, again, nostalgia for those of us who grew up during that time. It felt like a golden era of gaming. But I also just think that it was a golden era of gaming. And I'm always really delighted to hear, like, you know, I've given some talks at high schools or colleges. And these are kids who are, you know, 12 years, 15, 20 years younger than me, who did not grow up during that time.
Yeah.
And they still enjoy playing those kinds of games. So their fascination with it it's definitely not like a memory of their childhood, because they're still in their childhood. There is something about the games from that era that do seem to be really attractive and compelling to people of different ages.
Yeah, there's something magical about that gaming era that's still appealing today. What's your take on the current rivalry going on with Sony and Microsoft? How do you compare it to the rivalry between Nintendo and Sega in the 90s?
The most immediate thing is that it is not so much a rivalry, at least explicitly.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, anytime you're competing with someone for consumers and for market share, there is a rivalry aspect. But I think one thing that made the Sega Nintendo rivalry so fun was that the companies themselves explicitly like went after each other and you know, talked about what their company did and the other company didn't do. But you don't really see that from Sony and Microsoft today. They, at least publicly, are almost always very friendly towards each other, which I don't think is worse per se. You know, I can understand why they do that, and I think that at this point, gaming is ubiquitous enough that they don't really need to add fuel to the fire in a lot of ways.
Right.
But I think part of it too is that the systems are not as different than as Sega and Nintendo were,
yeah,
or maybe even as like Atari and Television were and stuff like that. You know, in a lot of ways, they are very similar. I'm sure that people from those companies would object, because of course there's a million things to make them different, but like, you know, I felt this is maybe this is a bad analogy, but like, you know, if my mom asked me in 1994, hey, what's the difference between Sega and Nintendo? I could go on and on about like, oh, well, Nintendo makes these kinds of games, Sega makes these kinds of games, and this is the attitude of Sega and the attitude of Nintendo. Whereas I would be hard-pressed to have a very long explanation with a layperson today about what's the big difference between Sony and Microsoft. It would probably just be, well, you know, they have some of them, there's different exclusives on different systems. And I would probably also credit Sony for the ways that they've been super successful, because they have been, and they deserve a lot of credit for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they do. Even Nintendo today, they're not as popular as they used to be, but they're still doing very well for themselves, like, even today.
They really, what, you know, one of the things that I learned when working on the book is that there really is like a Nintendo way, and they stick to that. And, you know, like I said earlier, that they are definitely less focused on consumer, like, demands, like explicit demands than other companies. They do what they think is going to be successful. And sometimes that works really, really well, like with the Wii and again with the Switch. And sometimes it works not so well with the Wii U, where to them, they thought it was very important that a tablet be attached to their console system, but it wasn't a tablet in the sense of like what Switch was. It was sort of a more in-between thing. Right. And it didn't do very well with the Wii U. And I think that's, you know, I think they have a similar mentality with their games as well. And I will just say also, like, you know, as a creative person, that's the best. You know, whenever I work with a producer or a publisher or anybody who's, you know, financing your work and paying for your creation, it's definitely it's more fulfilling for an artist than a creator to have the autonomy to do what they think is the best game, as opposed to the game that will sell the most, or to do something that will, you know, capture some gimmick, or, you know, like we see a lot in Hollywood, you know, if some sort of movie genre is successful, then there's a lot of copycats.
Right.
And, you know, whether you love or hate Nintendo, I think that we can all agree that Nintendo does not make too many copycat games. Everything feels very original and fresh. And that's, you know, that is a result of years of development and sticking to their guns. And they stick to their guns in a lot of ways. And
yeah, they choose to themselves, yeah.
Yeah. You know, the book is divided up into five sections. And the last section is called The Tortoise and the Hare.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really do think that is a good analogy for Sega and Nintendo, because the tortoise is doing what, you know, doing the best that he can, but and doing, you know, sticking to himself, and in the end of that story, he wins. In the end of the fable, he wins the race. But, you know, if you're writing a book, or if you're writing about the video game industry market, at a point in time, it's not always clear that the tortoise is going to win. You know, it might look like the tortoise is losing, and people will say, "What's wrong with Nintendo? Why are they doing this?" But in the end, you know, they keep coming back, and it's not. It shouldn't be a surprise at this point.
Yeah. Where do you see the future of the video industry going? Is it going more towards virtual reality, you think, down the line?
Well, I definitely have a very biased response on that, because I'm working on a new book about virtual reality, and I love virtual reality.
Yeah.
So I would say that, personally, I would like to see it move towards VR. But I think it's going to be a while until we get there.
Right.
I think, you know, I love so much what Sony has done with PSVR. I love that they are spending the money, and they were the first console company to get into VR, and they've been rewarded for it. You know, they've sold, I believe, over 2 million headsets at this point. But as super successful as that is in the VR space, you know, 2 million PSVR units is nothing compared to the, you know, actual PS4 unit sales or the Xbox One sales. So it's still going to take a while. You know, it's a good question, because, you know, when we talk about the games from the 16-bit era and the 8-bit era, and, you know, like you said, there's like a magical time. You know, one of the things that I think is, one of the things that makes it magical, in my opinion, is that you were a different character than yourself. Like, you know, when you play those games, you are not, you are not playing as yourself, a character in Call of Duty. You are not, it's not a first person game. It's like much more of a passive type experience, a passive narrative experience, where you are embodying someone else and playing with them from afar. But the trend in video games has mostly been towards first person gaming. And almost like the games are becoming more and more like simulations, which is neither a good thing nor a bad thing. But I think that, you know, VR is going to take, VR takes that to a whole other level where you feel like you're actually somewhere else. You actually aren't there. And I think that, that for the most part, that's awesome. Plus, there probably will still be a marked demand for more passive content and you know, sort of a less in the moment type of experience of gaming.
Right. Yeah. So in closing, what do you have up coming up next? You say you're writing another book right now?
Yeah, I've been working for the past few years on a book about virtual reality, and you know, specifically about Oculus and the you know, resurrection of consumer VR, and also getting into Sony and HTC and Valve, and you know, just this whole virtual reality revolution. What made it happen? What are the challenges? And again, like how sports, the behind-the-scenes story, where the you know, the human drama and the business decisions are really what drives the narrative, and I think makes it universal.
Right. Any additional date of when it'll be done or released, or are you just too far into the future right now?
Oh no, it's coming out this summer.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
For the console roles, are you still console wars? Are you still, is there still plans to make it into a movie?
Yep, we're still doing a documentary and a feature film. Oh. And I apologize to anyone for the delay, you know, and then also not having more information. That's mostly my fault for getting distracted with the new book. But everything is still moving along nicely at this point, knock on wood. And we should have a pretty big update soon on what's going to be happening with the documentary, the feature film. But, you know, so far, so good.
All right. We're definitely looking forward to it. Blake J. Harris, thank you for coming on the Throwback. We really appreciate you coming on today.
All right. Thanks so much, Ryan. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
Special thanks goes out to Blake J. Harris for taking time to come out on the Throwback.
Yeah, that guy's a smart man. He knows his video games, Daddy.
No argument for me. The 90s was a magical time for video games. Wouldn't you say, Jimmy?
Let me tell you something here now. I was into those video games back then, Daddy. I played them all. Virtual Boy was one of my favorites, but Nintendo 64 was pretty cool, too.
Yeah, I had a Nintendo 64. They had some pretty cool games.
Yeah, they sure did, Daddy. I played all of those games on there.
What were some of your favorites?
See, I like the GoldenEye 007 game, Zelda 64, and Star Fox 64, Daddy.
What about some of the Super Mario games on there?
Now, let me tell you here something there, Daddy. That Super Mario is a pill pusher, Daddy. You ever played any of those Dr. Mario games? He'd be shoving pills down your throat.
Wait, what? What are you talking about?
You ever played any of these Super Mario games, Daddy? That man is a pill pushing crackhead. He'd be smashing his head through them bricks and running around trying to save a princess that doesn't even exist. It's all in his head, Daddy. And don't get me started for his obsession with mushrooms. That's the science of a...
Okay, Jimmy, calm down. I think we get the picture. You're not a Super Mario fan.
No, Super Mario is a fraud, Daddy. I know guys on my old football team that can beat his ass.
Anyways, don't mind Jimmy. He hasn't had his morning coffee yet. Coming up on the next edition of the Throwback, we have some pretty cool guests from a very popular Nickelodeon show that will stop by on the Throwback. Be sure to check us out on Twitter, @ThrowPodcast, in the coming weeks to find out who.
Oh, who is it, Daddy?
You're just going to have to find out just like everyone else. Until next time. Oh, Jimmy, what's wrong? What are you looking at?
Oh, I got this 2-for-1 Checkers coupon that expired 2 weeks ago. Now I got to sell for Long John Silver. Those shrimps don't agree with me, Daddy. I think me and my ex-wife get along better.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out on Twitter @ThrowPodcast or on the web at www.blogtalkradio.com/throwback.